Hello, I'm Jack Auer.
And I'm Neely Rose.
And welcome to Fishing in the Swamp.
Today on the pod, we are interviewing our first local politician, State Senator Julian Sear. Senator Sear represents the Cape and Islands in the Massachusetts State Senate and was elected in 2016. He is a graduate of NYU and a former official in the Massachusetts Department of Health and has worked for the Clinton Global Initiative in the past. He is also a veteran of the Deval Patrick for Massachusetts and Barack Obama's 2012 re-election campaign. Senator Sear is also a Turo native and graduated from Nauset High School.
So both Neely and I are interested in going into politics, Senator Sear, and we just want to know, how did you get your start in politics?
So thank you, Jack and Neely, for asking me to come onto this podcast. I think it's great that we've seen this whole kind of blossoming of podcasts, and really thrilled to see you doing it here at Nauset. I got my start in politics actually here at Nauset. I was a junior at Nauset High School, regional high school, and I was really involved in the arts and music programs. I was in the orchestra, but most especially I was in the honors chorus, and had just an incredible experience. You know, went to Carnegie Hall, we won state. It was just I was a pretty academic student, and was really into that, but sort of the honors chorus became a really big outlet for me. And there were pretty significant budget cuts in 2003 as they were working on the school district budget, and there was a pretty sizable gap, over $1 million of gap in the budget. And if we couldn't convince the taxpayers in the four Nauset towns to pass what's called a Proposition 2.5 override, so basically agreeing to increase taxes above 2.5% to pay for quality education, if we couldn't convince taxpayers to do it, they were going to eliminate 40 teaching positions, including my choir teacher, Allison Bevan, who taught here at Nauset for quite some years. So I'd never done politics. My family is not, I guess we owned a restaurant. I grew up in a restaurant, so that's kind of a form of politics, but not a political family. So I didn't really know what I was doing, but I just really cared about this program and helped organize a group of 20, 25 students. And we met right here at Nauset in the library and planned a campaign, and we basically sought to communicate to voters what would be lost in quality education if voters at town meeting, if taxpayers didn't support the schools. And we were successful. It was kind of the first time I'd ever been involved in that. So that's how I kind of first sort of dipped my toe into politics. And I think first really realized that I could be part of something that could really affect and change my community. I think it was many years later and through many other experiences, I only figured out that, you know, hey, maybe I'd want to run for office. That was something I only figured out a few years ago. But that whole kind of journey and interest in public service started right here. And we're recording at Nauset, so that's what I'm saying here.
That's great. So
I think there's a myriad of ways. You know, we have our 18 or older. You know, you can vote, you can attend town meeting. You also can participate on government, right? We've got planning boards. Boards of health, the select board, all these things that make like really the future of the region. And so, you know, I think first, like, and foremost, it's really important those, you know, make sure you participate in that. And often those boards. So one, I'd encourage you to do that. And then I think for anyone, right, you know, part of the best, you know, politics when it's at its best, right? And so I'd say, you know, whether that's, you know, a candidate or a campaign, 2016, we're going to be ramping that back up. So if you're in, you know, if you're into kind of my politics, how to really engage with voters, mm-hmm. I think more and more our politics has become, you know, neighbors talking to neighbors, friends talking to friends, really having conversations with people who live here and explaining why folks to plug into. Plus, we have some really big, exciting races that are coming up statewide. Senator Warren's initiatives as well. So there's plenty of opportunities to be engaged. You want to be put to work.
Okay. So what is the biggest thing that you wish you had known about
politics? Wish I had known. I don't know if I actually wish that I knew this. I just didn't. I wasn't very confident in myself who would consider or could consider sort of running for office. You need all sorts of people in politics. So, you know, even if you look at the job that I have now, you know, I get to be the state senator, which is a very visible job, right? And I get I have a whole team of people who work for me. You know, there's five people who work in my office. You know, and some of them are kind of more behind the scenes people, right? They might not, their personality or sort of what of the state senator. just from a personality perspective, or a visibility perspective, that staff, without like volunteers and supporters, you know, I can't get elected without, you know, I can't knock. I wish I knew this. I just wasn't really confident in my own ability to do that. And it was sort of, maybe I should do this. Maybe I should run for office. So, you know, when I was in high school, I didn't, you know, if you look culturally and socially, Americans have like a little, we have like as corrupt or dirty, or there's something
say like right
always kind of like for a really long time, right? Sort of since actually really real, you know, culturally we're kind of like uncomfortable with
maybe
the messiness of it. And some of it's distrust, right? I think a lot of people don't feel heard by their government, don't feel heard by their elected officials, are discouraged by that. On trepidation too is saying, well, you know, I just had to kind of then again, I think it's sort of like a process to realize that like you maybe want to do this thing. And I think that so one involved, right? So, you know, you shouldn't have to feel. I think people really should look more closely at running. And what I found too, I think there's a little bit of a gender imbalance here. It tends to be when I look at younger folks who are thinking of running for office, it tends to be the guys, it tends to be the boys who tend to say, oh, well, like I'm running, especially, you know, white straight folk. And I think for women and other people who've had, you know, some sort of oppression or sort of, you know, identity, they have to be asked to run. And I think we see that, right? Women, and I made it a real point in asking women to run. So I think men are taught a little more in our society to say, oh, well, of course, you know, I can do this. Of course I should be elected. And I think women and other folks, and I had a bit of that in my own experience, just with my own identity as a queer person, kind of coming out and kind of figuring out that this is something that I wanted to do. So I think it's really important when you're in a position like mine to really be active about encouraging people to run, and especially encouraging women and minorities and queer folk to step up, and young people as well, to step up and run.
And I think in 2018, especially, more women are going to run, especially with this new movement.
We're already seeing that. The most women ever. I think they tripled the number that signed up for Emily's List.
Oh, it's even more than that. And even here on the Cape, so we had a women's march over Martin Luther King weekend to commemorate a year anniversary from the big women's march. And we had 2,000 people in Hyannis on the green. I mean, I've never seen that many people gathered anywhere on Cape Cod. I was really honored because I got to be one of the few guys that got up there and spoke. I spoke very briefly, and I basically asked them to run. I said, look, we need you to run. We need you to serve, you know, yes, in statewide office, you know, yes, in the kind of positions that I hold, you know, but also in our local towns, you know, getting involved in, you know, you look at so many of the concerns that we have here, right? Sustainability, the fact that this region's become profoundly unaffordable, and, you know, we are committed. We need all this participation.
I agree with that because I think you attended Boy State, and for me, like, that really helped me because I've always realized that it actually isn't as scary as it seems to be. And even though it was like a mock situation,
you run for Girl State.
What actually happened is I wanted to run. I wanted to be, didn't know anybody, and I was too scared to run for it. And then I regretted it for the rest of the week. But I got nominated my town sessions. And like all the girls in my town realized that I really did, like, I really love Politics Nation. I didn't get Girls Nation, but it showed that a lot of people like recognize.
Yeah, isn't it really powerful when like people believe in you and like ask you to do something? Or because I actually think that if you're interested in politics, having experience like that, like that's what's going to set you. Where in kind of this political universe, you know, do you play? Where is and I think honestly, I worked as a field organizer. You know, I worked as a worked in state government. I'm really good at this. I'm less good at that. I really love doing this. You know, when you're in my position, you get to be involved in a whole host of issues. It's hard to really do a deep, deep dive. And, you know, going to talk to people is great. The fundraising component of it is far less. But I think an experience like that you're talking about, Neely, you know, that's, you know, for pay attention to, like, what you're, like, telling yourself in your head. And just myself out there to do. But it's kind of a process to get there.
Definitely,
because it is pretty terrifying and scary. Put yourself out there. People ask me what running for like political office is like. And I'm sort of like, well, it's, I mean, at least for me, that's what the experience was like. And for a lot of my peers, they can relate to that.
Definitely.
Term gone. Has it been exceeded your expectations? Has it been more difficult than your expectations?
First of all, I mean, it's a real honor to have this job, and you get to do, you get to do. Someone calls my office, and either me or my, or more usually my staff helps them navigate something, you know, powerful stuff, and it keeps you going. I have been sort of pleasantly surprised. Senate has a more decentralized power structure than most legislative bodies are. Pretty top down, right? You're kind of like, you know, you're kind of like herding cats, right? If you're the Speaker or the Senate President.
Yeah.
And so often there's a lot of power that's sort of centralized. And in our Senate, we have a model that has much more of a shared leadership, shared responsibility model. And so that means that I've gotten to have so much more of a say. I mean, as a first term freshman, first year, I've been really surprised at what I've been able to have a say in. You know, we took up this major healthcare reform debate, and I was weighing in on, you know, four or five major issues on elder care issues and community health centers. I actually got the Senate to pass a study looking at how do we move to a single payer system. These are things I didn't expect that I'd be able to do. You know, certainly it's a really challenging job. The logistics of the job are really challenging, right? You've got to be, you know, so I represent, you know, Provincetown to Mashpee and then Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard. So in context, geographically, that's bigger than some of our congressional districts. So there's a lot of mileage to cover, and the aspects of the schedule, right? I could literally fill my schedule from, you know, 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. every day with requests, and we do that, right? That happens a lot, but that part is definitely can be a challenge. But I think overall, I've been really I'm really grateful for being able to serve in the Senate and to be able to really have this much of a voice, you know, this early. But still, you know, we've got a lot of accomplished some good things I'm proud of, but a lot of unfinished work and a lot of things we're hoping to finish. The legislative session is a 2-year session, so we're going to basically we start ramping up now, and we'll go to the end of July is sort of when we've got to get everything done from a legislative perspective.
Yeah.
So a lot of incompletes, if I'm grading myself. But I feel good about where I'm going.
What do you think is the single biggest problem facing the Cape right now?
Affordability. Not only have we not kept up with housing production, but our housing and our real estate market is not geared towards those of us who live here year-round, but it's geared towards a community, right? I mean, these... you know, I come from a family who, you know, we made our living off of having a seat. But I think that we have been slow as a region to affordable homes for young families who are starting out. There's very few options. It's driving a population decline. So if you look at population projections, so we are Commonwealth. It's the third oldest in the country. And if you look at our, you know, the... NAWSED actually has been able to stem some of this through school choice, but the class of the sending towns of the four NAWSED towns are half the size they were, you know, when 14, 15, 16 year period, you know, we're seeing that housing affordability is just the primary issue out here. So we have not built wastewater systems in most other places in the Commonwealth and towns. I'm leading an effort with Representative Sarah Peek and other colleagues. How does the state bring some financial support for that? So I think that's really the issue that's going to determine a place that has a year-round, vibrant, you know, sustainable community, or whether I think, you know, the thing that makes me optimistic is a lot of folks really care about the issue. There's about the issue to really push it, and so that makes me more optimistic.
Cape Cod, here on Cape Cod, too. Is there anything that the state legislator is doing to combat?
The legislature passed a bill several years ago that sort of took a first step, really focusing on restriction of prescription of prescribed opioids. And there's been a real, because of those policies and efforts, there's been like a sustained reduction in that. It's been, there's been broadly some success. Where we have not been as successful is in providing that continuum of care for people. And also that we've seen in recent years the emergence of fentanyl and carfentanyl and other synthetics that are being added to heroin that are, the potency is 10 times or 100 times that of heroin. And so it's leading to more overdoses and more deaths related to that overdose. I think we've got to do a few things. We've got to do a number of things. I think that there's been some progress that's been made, but we're still losing lives, especially on Cape Cod, especially mm-hmm. if you look at the data out of the Mid-Cape and the Upper Cape.
Yeah.
This is a really pernicious epidemic. I'm a public health guy. I worked in public health for, mm-hmm. for a number of years. And so, you know, I like to look at the epidemiology and I look to look at like health interventions. And I think the last time, if you look at morbidity and mortality, the last time we had as significant as an epidemic as we have right now is the AIDS epidemic in the 80s mm-hmm. and early 90s. And what really turned that epidemic around, you know, yes, it was the emergence of, you know, drug therapies that came along in the mid 90s. But almost as important was out of the box solutions that people, you know, that made folks uncomfortable, right? Condom distribution, needle exchange, things that now are kind of bread and butter public mm-hmm. health intervention that we know work. You know, we've got to be looking at, in the opiate epidemic, right? What is the out of the box thinking that we need to be, we need to be doing to saving lives? And I think we also need to really pay attention to, you know, what happens when someone overdoses and then is brought to the emergency department and the emergency room. You know, what happens, right, to that person and the care that they receive in the hospital, and then how do you get them into treatment,
yeah.
and how do you sustain them in treatment? Right now, insurance is only mandated to cover up to 14 days of treatment. That's basically a detox and a little bit of step-down services. If you look at the evidence and the research around this, it takes 7, 8, 9 years for someone of recovery mm-hmm. to be considered. That's the average time recovery takes, and it's often a lifetime. And so we don't have programs and policies that are in that time frame. And I think until we do, this is going to remain a very challenging epidemic that's impacting families significantly. We're going to be taking up some legislation this winter and early spring on the opiate epidemic. I'm planning to look at there's a number of grandparents who are now raising grandchildren because of the opiate epidemic. Trying to also look at how do you expand what services paramedics can provide. Often paramedics are and the police are sort of seeing many of the same people who are overdosing. They're bringing them to the emergency department. How do you give them with more services? And really looking at other, you know, out-of-the-box ideas and interventions that will save lives.
The governor made a big, in his State of the Commonwealth speech, he made like the opioid epidemic a major part of it. What is it like having a Republican governor in a heavily Democratic state? And especially because he's a very popular governor too. He's like the most well-liked governor in the country, which is really interesting, I find.
So, you know, I don't work with the governor too much directly, but I do work with his secretaries and lieutenant governor. And you know, I think first and foremost, 8 or 9 out of 10 of the issues you're dealing with in state government and local government, it's not partisan stuff. And so, you know, really broadly, I think this is like a collaborative administration. And I have complaints, as I'm sure, you know, he has about the legislature. You know, I do think that sometimes I see the governor is – I find the governor is a little, like, cautious. I think his State of the State, you know, talks about – a lot of things that he and the legislature has accomplished together, and that's good. You know, sometimes I want to hear a little more vision about, you know, what can Massachusetts be, that we shouldn't be resting in our laurels, you know, and I think that, you know, yes, we're the number one state for education, we're the number one state for innovation, you know, all these things. We're also the 45th state for economic inequality. You know, we've got, you know, if Massachusetts was a standalone country, we'd be one of the wealthiest countries in the world. And yet, you know, we have, and y'all know this, here in the school community, here across Cape Cod, here across the Commonwealth, people who are really struggling, you know, and I think people who feel left behind and who have been left behind, especially in this changing economy, you know, so I'd like to see a little vision. You know,
yeah.
Interestingly, so like inside baseball in Beacon Hill, having a, you know, so really there's, you know, we have... the legislature is very powerful, and mm-hmm. it's dominated by supermajorities of Democrats.
Yeah.
So often the tension can be between the House and what their leadership wants to do in the Senate. on what they'd like to do.
And the Republicans in the legislature aren't really extreme Republicans either. They're more moderate, would you say?
There's a mix. In the Senate, we have wonderful Republicans. I work really closely with Senator Davina DiMacedo, who represents the Upper Cape and Plymouth. Bruce Tarr, the minority leader, is a guy I work with a lot on fishery issues. He represents Gloucester. You know, I think there's a comedy and a collaborativeness. You know, but often the tension can be between the House, which is mm-hmm. a little more conservative, the Senate, which is much more progressive,
yeah.
And that in a way, having a Republican governor is something that sort of politically we're used to, right? So from the Weld years through Romney, you know, you had 18 mm-hmm. years with a Republican governor. I think sometimes, and when I worked in the Patrick administration, I worked both in the Patrick administration, Baker administrations, and then came into the legislature. And the Democratic-controlled legislature kind of didn't know what to do sometimes with this progressive governor they had. And so, you know, I think it's all politics is really local. And so I think that if you're really going to look at Massachusetts politics, the frame is really not a sort of – the frame is less so like Republican and Democrat and more so, you know, moderate Republican, centrist Democrat, progressive Democrat – and how the triangulation of those sort of three negotiates what priorities are going to happen, what's going to get funded, and that's sort of where the power struggle is, yeah. is between those camps, less kind of in a black and white partisan piece, mm-hmm. which to me actually is kind of refreshing in some way. You know, it's such a toxic national environment. I really like that I get to collaborate, and I do work really closely with my colleagues in the Cape delegation. You know, we've got Democrats and Republicans, mm-hmm. And that's pretty nice. But sometimes the disagreements are more between, you know, the centrist Democrats and the progressive Democrats,
yeah.
than Republicans.
So turning to national politics, DACA is a very big issue right now, and you've been attacked by some Republicans because of your position on immigration. Do you think that, what is your stance on Dreamers, and do you think a government shutdown is appropriate?
So I've been there's been an off Cape like dark money PAC. It's called Mass Fiscal Alliance. They don't really have to report their donors. They are able to get several wealthy people are able to come together and you know they've been funneling misleading information about a position I've taken in support of the Safe Communities Act. The Safe Communities Act is all about respecting the autonomy that our municipal town. Police departments and law enforcement have. So it basically prohibits the federal government from coming in and deputizing local police to do the bidding of immigration, to do the bidding of ICE. You know, look, immigration has been a failed policy at the federal level, you know, now going on decades. I don't believe it should be the responsibility of our local police departments mm-hmm. To have to clean up for the feds and do their job. I made it a point to sit down with you know, a number of our police departments and police chiefs. This is not an issue that they talk about. They talk about the opiate epidemic. We talk about traffic safety out here on you know, along Route yeah. 6. We talk about, you know, a whole host of those challenges. Immigration isn't one. And so, you know, I think this is a bit of a red herring. I think that, you know, for most of the folks I represent, you know, aren't, if they're concerned about immigration, I think one, they're concerned about TPS, which is a federal policy, the temporary status, protective status for Haitians and for El Salvadorians. And Salvadorians in particular, there's a big community in Nantucket. I think the other major immigration issue here is about workforce and about H-2B and J-1 visa programs. These are federal programs that allow folks to come in. So that's what I've been focused on at a state mm-hmm. level. You know, nationally, I mean, these are how anyone cannot support providing a pathway to citizenship for Dreamers, you know, not only is it sort of morally wrong, but moreover, these are young people just like you guys and me that our communities and our country is invested in, right? Mm-hmm. We've spent millions of dollars educating people, these people, building them into our communities. I mean they are as American as you and me. And so, I just really hope there's a solution on that. You know, I've never worked in Congress. I'm not in the halls of Congress. It's hard to stay sort of strategically. You know, did the shutdown make sense? Did it pay off? And I think sometimes you got to look at this stuff at the end outcome, you know. But really, I think that, you know, not providing a pathway for citizenship to Dreamers is just it's completely un-American. And I think that history is going to show that, you know, this sort of xenophobic moment that we're in right now is one that we're not going to look back upon fondly. And I think it's going to be seen as a mistake if you look broadly at the promise of this country, the wealth of this country, the opportunity in this country. So much of that has been driven by immigration. And, you know, I think that, unfortunately, immigration's been used, is being used, you know, as a dog whistle issue, and I think as something that is a distraction from, you know, broadly, that we haven't done a good job, you know, lifting people up, investing in and supporting, you know, the working poor and working class, and middle class people as well. I mean, wages have broadly been stagnant, you know, and for decades, that's not a partisan, you know, this is something that has happened under Republicans and Democrats, right? But, you know, I am grateful. I am grateful to serve on Beacon Hill and not on Capitol Hill in this moment, that's for sure.
So the President's State of the Union address was the other night. And what do you think the state of our union is right now?
I mean, so I actually think broadly the state of the union is very strong because I think the United States has a lot of resilient institutions. We have a broadly sort of like purposely decentralized federal government system, right? So there's a lot of checks and balances there. And I think that, you know, and I think that more people are engaged and watching and wanting to get involved than ever before. And I think a lot of that is in reaction to Trump. Mm-hmm. And so to me, you know, I think there's a lot of strength there. You know, the kind of question is, you know, how much damage is done before this is sort of this course correction, you know, before there's a course correction, before all this is averted. You know, and I think that's hard to say. But I think, you know, what is clear to me, I think, is that, you know, the status quo of our politics is not serving people well. I think that, you know, I'd like to see Democrats and Republicans, you know, focused on, you know, getting things done and addressing big issues. And, you know, that's, you know, so sometimes I'm a little sort of sad about obviously where we are, but I think, but then I look at the people, you know, I look at my friend, you know, I look at folks who I see have been involved in, who just got involved in politics, right? Who are just, you know, And we saw this at the Women's March, you know, and I look at that and I look at, like, I'm like, wow, all these people are like, they get it. They get that, like, for us to have a vibrant representative democracy, you've got to participate. And I think I see a lot of promise among the millennial generation, among, I don't know what technically your generation's called, Generation Z or something.
I don't know what we are.
I kind of think of you as millennials, although I know you're not. You know, and in a certain way, it's like if only we can. I think this moment of, you know, discord and dysfunction, to me, I think is breeding a lot of consensus, you know, at least among millennials about, all right, you know, that this is a multicultural and a diverse country, that our strength lies in that, a desire to have some just common sense, good governance, you know, and a part of this is, you know, I think we've got to wait to some folks sort of cycle out, but you know, that's what makes me optimistic. And I think we just need more and more of those folks stepping up, being involved, and, you know, and you know, I think time will tell.
Yeah. Do you think 2018 will be a good year?
At some real structural barriers that are there.
Definitely.
You know, districting and how, look, both, and we have gerrymandered districts here in Massachusetts. You know, we've got this sort of, they were really effective at super gerrymandering. Yeah. You know, and I think one is you try to have really big wins in 2018, then in 2020, so you gerrymander it back in your favor. Are doing around really kind of moving towards a districting process that's nonpartisan. Let's have work to do on our message. I think that, you know, I'd really like to see it be someone who isn't someone who's in their 70s.
Do you have like a top pick at the moment?
Well, I'm a little biased here because I got to work and campaign for him, but I think
Obama wants him to run, or
I think there's a lot of folks who would he would. I mean, he's a really, I think that he would really have a lot to offer, and I think that he really, you know, devolves, right? This is a guy who never ran for political office, you know, was a wins, you know, and talks about a politics of, you know, and I think that message, I think people are hungry for that. Sit here and, you know, a little prognostication and the punditry is fun. My own race, right? I mean, so when I initially kind of decided to do this, it was sort of like, all right, what do I have to lose? You know, it's kind of going to be this quick, you know, I was up against, you know, three other Democrats. There was four Democrats in the primary, was up against, you know, I wasn't necessarily kind of supposed to win this thing, right? The pundit sort of a year before the election probably wouldn't expect that I would have won the state Senate seat and won the percentage that we did. And that's kind of cool. Like, I like that about politics. And I think the more that we have that opportunity, I think the better it is. So you know, we'll see what happens in 2020. I mean, it's a long, in one sense, it's a long ways away politically. Yeah. In another, it's going to be here really, really soon.
Anyway, it's hard to believe it's already 2018 because I feel like I've been waiting for midterm elections, but I can't believe it's already here. So
yeah, it's so we'll see. But I think there's excitement about that. And I think that. You know, so I don't know. We'll see. And there's plenty of really good, talented people who I love. You know, I shouldn't. You know, I love Joe Biden. I love Senator Warren. You know, and I think there's a whole host of talented folks around the country, who, gosh, you know, if they're willing to put themselves through that, which is pretty, pretty intense.
Can anything up 2016? Like,
learned most is to, especially through 2016. Is you're just going to sort of live in the wreckage of your projected future. Mm-hmm. So, you know, unless he's impeached, even if he is impeached, we'll probably be in the mix, at factor for sure.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, hopefully we'll sort of basic stuff, but. You know.
So finally, both of us love to watch TV shows in our downtime.
You know, historically, you know, I've always loved, it's kind of inappropriate and out there, but it's like South. For news, I'm like a big fan of the PBS NewsHour. Mm-hmm. I was pretty devastated when Gwen Ifill. I think maybe I need like a real, like need more of a release and distraction. It's their All Stars show season 3, and then I've gotten a friend who's trying to get me hooked on Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. I traditionally haven't watched as much TV, but I think now sometimes it's really nice to kind of unplug. You know, that's what the nice thing now is, you know, if you miss the show, you can just watch it on the
True. Mm-hmm. I'm more into House of Cards. Mm-hmm. I have not watched The West Wing yet, though.
So. Yeah, House of Cards. Although, I didn't
see the all-season Robin Wright that they're going to have come out next really year.
So. Oh, maybe I'll just skip to that.
I know.
I love your maybe I'm focused so much on politics. And
well, we really want to thank you for coming on the podcast as our first guest.
Oh my God, thank you to Jack and
election.
Good luck thank in 2018.
You and good luck to the two of you. You're going to be graduating in May, right?
Yes.
Yes.
And then headed on place, hopefully, fingers crossed. This is a really marvelous, exciting time, and just congratulations and enjoy it. And if you want to come and knock some doors and make some calls this spring and summer, you know where to find me. So thank you for having me on.
Thank you very much.